The final case for oral argument this morning is in the interest of L.N., an abused, alleged abused and neglected child. For the appellant mother, P.W., is Mr. Jeff Larson, attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the Appalachian State of South Dakota is Ms. Ann Holhauser, an assistant attorney general. Mr. Larson, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Jeff Larson from the Public Defender's Office in Sioux Falls, and I'm here today representing P.W., who is challenging the trial court's termination of her parental rights to her young son, L.N. This appeal is a challenge to the constitutionality of the no reasonable efforts provisions of SDCL 26-8A 21.1 and 21.2. And because of somewhat unique nature of this appeal, if it is okay with the court, I would like to start by going through a brief review of the statutory scheme and then go through the procedural history of this case, which is more important than the normal factual history, and weave my argument into the procedural history as it developed. If the court wishes me to proceed in another matter, please correct me as I go, but I think that I'll start out in that direction anyway. SDCL 26-8A-21 starts off with the basic statement that the Department of Social Services shall make reasonable efforts to not remove children from the home, and if removed, to return children to the home. The following statute, however, is 26-8A-21.1, which is important to this case, which says nothing in the previous statute requires reunification of a child with a parent who meets one of the 9 exceptions to the reasonable efforts requirement. The 2 exceptions relevant to this case are subdivision 5, a parent who has previously had parental rights involuntarily terminated to another child, and subdivision 6, a parent who has a history of neglect related to chronic alcohol abuse. The following statute is 26-8A-21.2, which says if the court makes a determination that reasonable efforts are not appropriate by a finding of one of the factors in 21.1, a permanency hearing shall be held within 30 days. And at that permanency hearing, the court is limited to 4 options. 1, place the child for adoption and have the state file a petition for termination. And we'll discuss that further, but that seems to infer there is a subsequent hearing, and it's a somewhat unusual use and placement of the word of petition. 2, legal guardianship. 3, relative placement. Or 4, a planned permanent living arrangement. There is nothing in the statutory scheme with which the state proceeded on that specifically talks about whether a dispositional hearing should be held, and there is nothing within the 4 options that once the finding of 21.1 is made that ever allows a child to be returned to the custody of a parent. It is because of those 2 things that PW asserts that the statutory scheme that was applied to her is an unconstitutional taking of her liberty interest to her child without due process of law. A timeline is somewhat instructive in this case. LN was born on May 15th of 2003. Because of some special needs that he had, he was still hospitalized on June 11th of 2003 when the state filed an abuse and neglect petition. And on the 12th, they took custody of the child before he was released from the hospital. So neither parent actually ever had physical custody of the child outside the hospital. On June 23rd, Judge Nealis brought the parents in for an advising of rights, at which time Judge Nealis advised that there would be an adjudicatory hearing, and if there was an adjudication, it would be followed by a second stage called a disposition. where the judge can either return the child to either or both parents or take action such as termination of parental rights. That's what my client was advised at her advising hearing on June 23rd. On August 22nd of 2003, an adjudicatory hearing was held before Judge Lieberman, at which time he adjudicated LM to be an abused or neglected child under 26.8A(2)(9), which has to do to prenatal exposure to alcohol because there was a diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome. At the close of that hearing, the state's attorney announced that they were requesting a no reasonable efforts finding under 26.8A(21)(1) and would be requesting an expedited hearing. The no reasonable efforts hearing was held on September 9th, followed by a permanency hearing, which was continued at one point because the father raised an issue of paternity, which was unresolved, with the permanency hearing being held on November 17th of 2003. It should be noted that no dispositional hearing was ever held in this case. I would like to now pick up the discussion with the events that happened at the no reasonable efforts hearing on September 9th of 2003. It was clear from the outset that the state had declared that it was subdivisions 5 and 6 of 21.1 that they would be addressing to request the no reasonable efforts, the chronic alcohol abuse and neglect associated with it, and the prior termination of parental rights. At the beginning of the hearing, I made it a limiting objection to keep out any evidence that didn't go to either of those two factors because that's what mother was on notice that she was defending against. Could they produce a certified copy of a judgment showing a prior adjudication? And they could introduce evidence relative to chronic history of alcohol abuse as it affected the raising of the children. But I objected to any evidence beyond that point being put in at a permanency, at the no reasonable efforts hearing. At page 9 of the no reasonable efforts transcript, the court makes, I think, a very telling comment, where Judge Lieberman says quite honestly, "To be honest with you, I am not sure what this hearing is, quite frankly," which is the problem with the statute, is the statute is not very clear on what the hearings are to be. But it seems to be clear from the statutory scheme that if you are making a motion to proceed with the no reasonable efforts, that hearing should be confined to those subsections to which the state is proceeding under. The state's position was that the past history of the prior adjudications was relevant, but that would seem to be the factors that would be more appropriate to a dispositional hearing, which was clear that a no reasonable efforts hearing was not. At page 14 of the transcript, the court agrees that the discussion should be limited by those factors, but then says, "I'm not really going to limit those because I want to hear more," and did grant me a standing objection. Later on in that hearing, I did make my objections to the fact that it appeared that we were going forward without ever having a dispositional hearing, and that would be a denial of due process, and that in effect what we had embarked upon was a form of summary judgment termination of parental rights. And I gave the example at that hearing, which I think is appropriate to our discussion here, which is arguendo if the state proceeds only under the prior termination statute, and the state asserts that my client has been previously terminated. Say she lost a prior child when she was 15 because she was frankly not mature enough to raise the child and she has an involuntary termination. But years later, she's doing fine. She places her child in a daycare where the child is sexually abused unbeknownst to her. There's an adjudication for abused or neglected child because that's not fault-oriented. It has to do with the status of the child. At that point, the state would be entitled under that statute to request no reasonable efforts because there's been a prior termination, and there is absolutely no remedy that the statute allows a trial court to ever, if it makes a finding that there was a prior termination, which is a matter of judicial notice, there is nothing to stop the train on the tracks towards termination because the statutes allow no alternatives to a judge that would allow them to place the child back with the family. Only termination of parental rights, legal guardianship, relative placement, or what they called a planned permanent living arrangement. That is where the problem arises from the constitutional standard, because first of all, there's never a right to litigate least restrictive alternative, which is long held to be a basic fundamental right to litigate that before parental rights are terminated. And also I raised the issue of the void for vagueness under the Papachristou case, which may seem bizarre, but if you take a step back, the whole basis of challenging the vagrancy statutes back in the civil rights movement was that it was a usurpation of judicial power into the hands of law enforcement. That something was vague enough that the enforcement of the law, who got punished, was put in the hands, in this case, of the police department of the city of Jacksonville.
So on one hand, you're saying this is so specific you don't get to present a case, and on the other hand, you're saying it's void for vagueness.
No, I don't think so. It's so specific that once the Department of Social Services, an administrative branch of government, makes a decision, and they admit in the record that they don't always make that choice, but once they make the decision, and that's the void for vagueness part, is the administrative branch of government making the decision and not judicial. Once they make the decision, then we don't get to present the case and we don't have the due process element of presenting arguments relative to least restrictive alternative.
Well, it's not just them, though. The court has to make a finding that no reasonable efforts are necessary.
But the only thing that they have to make a finding is that one of the 9 exceptions of 21.1 are made. There is nothing that gives them permissive authority to go beyond that. And that's where the problem is. For this statutory scheme not to be flawed, there has to be a provision for the trial court to have discretion to make a finding that a factor exists, but also make a finding that something other than the 4 options of 21.2 are appropriate, and that is not given as an option to the trial courts in this statutory scheme.
21.1 doesn't say that reasonable efforts are prohibited if a finding is made. It simply says nothing in the prior section is required.
It says nothing in 21 requires unification if, and then it gives those. That allows the Department of Social Services or the state's attorney's office, the executive branch of government, to make a decision on whether to request no reasonable efforts. But once a no reasonable efforts finding has been made, and sure, the court has a decision on whether it's going to make a finding, but in the fact of a prior termination, that's merely looking at a certified copy of a judgment. That's the decision the court makes. In subsection 6, the court has more discretion to determine whether or not there's a history of chronic alcohol abuse. That's more of a factual determination.
But you're not really suggesting that a court would do that. Say, for instance, the example that you proposed before about an incident that happened years before, and you now have a great parent, and they come in. I can't imagine a court under that section saying, well, no reasonable efforts are going to be required today.
Okay.
It's something that happened 10 years ago.
But I don't think the court has that choice. That's the problem. And I don't think the court would. I worry about what a prosecutor's office or a Department of Social Services would. And that's where that decision is made. If, in my example, they go forward and they show a prior termination, then that leads to a permanency hearing. And at the permanency hearing, the trial court only has 4 options. And in my example, the trial court only has the option to place for adoption and file a petition for termination, make a legal guardianship, make a relative placement, or a planned permanent living arrangement. There is not another option given to the court. Should there be? Of course. Would a trial court be imaginative and try to construe that law so it could, in my example? Probably so. Would they have the statutory authority to do so? I think not. And that's where the problem lies.
Well, the permanency hearing also requires the court to determine that a permanent placement is, I think the statute uses the words appropriate. And how can a court decide that a permanency determination is appropriate?
Because the only finding they have to have to do that is making a finding that 21.1 is met. If the court has determined that reasonable efforts are not appropriate, which according to 21.1 is if one of nine subsections are met, if they make that factual determination, then they have four options. That's the problem. I wish the statute had the out that you're talking about, Justice Sinner, because I think that should be an option. And I think the statute would not be constitutionally flawed if that were there. But it isn't there. And that is the problem with the statutory scheme. If there were the chance for judicial discretion, then I wouldn't have an argument. But it says, if the courts determine that reasonable efforts are not appropriate, but if you take that in sequence of what that means that five and six have been proven, then there are four options to the court.
Is that what the trial court did here, though? Did the trial court take the position that 26, that, so let's just say subsection 21, limited him to making these findings, and once he made those, he had no option. He could not consider lesser included alternatives?
He said that he didn't think it was necessary and that he would hope that it wouldn't be determined in, I believe his term was, a mechanistic manner. But he did concede at page 65 of the no reasonable effort hearing that my client was being deprived of a termination hearing, and his statement was, is the well-being of the child trumps the mother's right to have a dispositional hearing in this case. And that's the problem, is that a dispositional hearing is a fundamental constitutional protection, which is the only place where concepts such as least restrictive alternative can be litigated.
All right, so you didn't get a dispositional hearing. Did you get an opportunity at the permanency hearing to offer what you could have offered at a dispositional?
My argument was that a permanency hearing didn't allow me to do that, because the permanency hearing only allows me to litigate which of the four options are available, and that I was never on notice that I was allowed to have a dispositional hearing. He did make a statement while ruling on an evidentiary objection on whether or not the rules of evidence applied, that, well, this is kind of like a dispositional hearing, so I'm going to not be bound by the rules of evidence. That's the first counsel knows, that he doesn't have a dispositional hearing, because we are told that at the no reasonable efforts hearing that we are not going to have a dispositional hearing.
All right, but I know you're arguing from the statute, but I'm asking about what actually happened. Was there an opportunity? Did the court say, I will give you the opportunity if you've got testimony or evidence that you want to put on for a lesser alternative? Was that opportunity given to you?
I don't recall it being given, and I can't say that I studied the record on that particular issue.
Not that that binds you whether he
right.
did or not, but I understand your argument, but
right.
I just wanted to know what happened.
I don't recall that he ever specifically said that. I mean, he may have said, do you have any witnesses you wish to call at this hearing? Would be the only thing that I could remember that would be similar to that, but again, it's just on recollection.
And at that time, you were taking the position that the statute precluded it.
Exactly. And in fact, I was objecting to extraneous matter being brought in by the state because, for example, they tried to bring in evidence of what a good foster or what a good adoptive placement the foster family would be, which is at page 15 of the permanency hearing, and I objected to that because that wasn't an issue to be determined here. It was only whether it was to be an adoptive placement or a long-term foster care, or those four options. And at the permanency hearing, the court even says that this bizarre statute, which says place for adoption and direct the state to petition for termination of parental rights, that was merely, to quote the court, a ministerial signing. But I would argue to the court that the fact that it talks about there being a petition, that consistent with this court's ruling in IH, that there is contemplated that there be a dispositional hearing at some point during this process, even if it is an abbreviated process. And none of that was ever made available to my client here.
We have a provision in constitutional law that says that something to the effect that even though a statute may appear to be unconstitutional on its face, it can be salvaged if the court gives a constitutional interpretation to the statute.
Yes.
Is there a way that we could look at this section 21 and say where it says nothing requires, that as Justice Innert alluded to, it doesn't say nothing prohibits? And we could interpret it that way, thus making it constitutional, even if your argument's correct that it is.
I don't think so. And I see I'm running out of time. If I could have permission just to answer that question. If you read it, the statute sequentially, 21 says you must make reasonable efforts. The nothing requires are the next two words after section 20, which to me makes it very clear that says we don't have to make reasonable efforts. If it's this, so it's this. And it gives you the areas for them to determine. My argument to the court is very simply, if that was the intent of the legislature, then the subsequent 21.2 would give options that included return to the family, and those aren't in there. And that if you read them sequentially, I don't think that interpretation makes sense the way that they come in sequence in the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Ms. Holhauser, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name again is Ann Holzhauser, and I appear on behalf of the state. Well, Mr. Larson is correct in that the procedures used in this case are probably more important than the facts. I think there are some facts that are worthy of mention. First off, the mother in this case is a chronic alcoholic. In fact, her struggle with alcoholism led to the involuntary termination of her parental rights to three other children. Most recently, her rights to a child whose initials were AN were terminated within a few short months of the birth of the child in the pending case. In addition, she received repeated alcohol treatment or repeated services intended to address and help assist her with addressing her problem with alcoholism. Nevertheless, mother continued to drink. She continued to drink during the case involving AN or AN. The courthouse doors had hardly closed when she started to drink again, as reference stories indicated by the fact that this child was born with FAS. Further, even though the child was removed from her care and services were offered to her to help her address her alcoholism, she continued to drink in this case. In addition, mother was incarcerated at the time of what turned out to be the final hearing in this case. She had been arrested for her third DUI offense during the case involving AN and was sentenced in July of 2003 to 2 years in the penitentiary. So at the time of the final hearing, she was in fact incarcerated in the penitentiary. I don't think I'll spend a lot of time going into the procedural history of the case. I think Mr. Larson has set that out for the court. I would beg to differ, though, obviously, on the constitutionality of the sections in question. And first, I'd note that counsel has attempted to, at times, read those sections in a vacuum. And I think our law is clear that we don't do that in determining whether or not a provision of the statute is constitutional. That we must look at not only the language of the statute in question, but the context in which the statute appears. For turning the attention first to section 26.8.8.21.1, I would argue that that section does in fact, when read in conjunction with other sections, give the court discretion to decide whether, even though a criteria is met, whether under the circumstances of the case in question, it is appropriate or not to require reasonable efforts towards reunification. As pointed out.
So you're basically stating that on behalf of South Dakota, the state of South Dakota. That's the state's position.
Correct.
And you understand that could be used in future litigation.
Correct.
Okay. Let me ask you this. You're involved in hundreds of these cases. Mm-hmm. Are there situations in which circuit judges have found that you still must provide reasonable efforts, even though you've identified and proven a aggravating circumstance?
To be honest with you, I don't know if I'd say that I'm involved in hundreds of cases, and those cases which reach my desk are those involving an appeal. And in most cases where there has been an appeal, there's been no reasonable efforts ruling where, in fact, the department has been relieved of its obligation to provide reasonable efforts.
You're only seeing the termination cases. You're not seeing the cases that are the children are returned to the parents.
In the scope of my position within the department, yes, because my primary role is to handle appeals. So I don't know that I would be a good source of information as far as that. I don't dispute what Mr. Larson had said, and I think there was a stipulation in the record that the department in some cases may decide not to pursue a no reasonable efforts ruling because the parent has rehabilitated since the time, for example, of a prior involuntary termination. But I would suggest that that doesn't mean that the department has unfettered discretion. As I argued in the state's brief, the decision whether or not to bring a no reasonable efforts motion to the court's attention can be made by someone other than the department. And there are criteria that defines when the court may relieve the department of providing no reasonable efforts are specific within the statute. In fact, Mr. Larson has acknowledged the same. In a sense, he said it's too specific. But again, I think the statute does, when read in the context of the statutory scheme, including Section 21.2, I think the court has discretion to say, even though some of these criteria are met, a prior involuntary termination, I, being the court, am going to find that the department will be required to provide reasonable efforts. But even if the court makes that determination, I don't think the statute, I differ in Mr. Larson's position that the statute requires that the train start rolling with an inevitable outcome that there will be termination of parental rights. In that regard, I think 21.2, which is the other provision which Mr. Larson has challenged the constitutionality of, allows the court to consider whether or not, in fact, the child will be reunified with the parents. I acknowledge that it's not listed as one of the options, but the prefatory language in that provision says if the court determines, then the court shall determine whether or not adoption or one of the other options will be pursued. I'd also suggest that there's nothing in the statute that suggests or that requires that permanency hearing be the last hearing. The court could very well find that it's going to continue the case and allow the departments, even though there's a no reasonable efforts ruling, allow the parents to attempt to address the concerns that prevent them from parenting the child. So the court could continue the hearing. And if that's true, then we fall within the provisions of the other sections of the statute, which talk about permanency hearings and dispositional hearings. So again, just because Section 21.2 itself does not specifically list as an option return of the child to the parent's custody, I don't think it's ruled out that in fact the court can consider that. Although Mr. Larson, we haven't gotten into discussion it so much this morning, I think it's worthy of mention too, or worthy of argument, that we should not get hung up so much on semantics. And I guess that goes to whether or not Mr. Larson's client was afforded the opportunity for a so-called dispositional hearing. In that regard, it suggests that what's important is the nature of the hearing involved or the nature of the hearing that was provided, not the name that is given to the hearing. Section 26.8.8.21.2 and other provisions within the statute, which within Chapter 26.8.8, talk about permanency hearings, but don't prohibit the court from having what's called a dispositional hearing, or if the hearing is the last hearing in the case, a final dispositional hearing before the date or at the same time as the date of the permanency hearing. I note that the other provisions which address permanency hearings, and I think it's 26.8.8.26, talk about that if the court does not enter a final dispositional order, by the time that 12 months come around, then the court must have a permanency hearing. But that's not to say that the court cannot have a dispositional hearing prior to that time. And I think that's consistent with prior case law.
Did the mother in this case get the opportunity to put on any evidence on lesser restrictions, lesser alternatives?
I think the mother in this case had that opportunity, or that opportunity was presented. I don't think she availed herself of that opportunity. I think the court was clear in the time of the no reasonable efforts ruling that it would hold another hearing. It used the term permanency hearing, but it made clear that that would be the final hearing in the case if the court found that termination was warranted. So I think that mother was on notice that in fact would be treated or could be treated as a final dispositional hearing.
I read the remarks of the judge, at least at some points, it looks as if he is taking the position that he has no choice, that once he goes through 21.1, makes that finding, the only other choices he does have are the four choices.
And I acknowledge that at times the trial court judge did indicate or seemed to indicate that he was somewhat constrained by the provisions of the statute. But what I'd suggest to you is that we need to look not at what the court's words were, or not at what the hearing was called, the name given to the hearing in the notice, or the name given to the hearing by the parties in question. We need to look at instead what happened at the hearing and what the parties were told would happen at the hearing. During the hearing that was scheduled for October, the early part of October, the state's attorney indicated at that time that at the continuation of the hearing, the state would be pursuing termination of parental rights, or would be going forward under that provision of 21.2. I think it's clear, and again, the court made the remarks that if in fact it found termination was warranted, that would be the final hearing in the case. All the other attorneys or the other counsel recognized and treated the hearing when they came together on November 17th as a dispositional hearing. And by dispositional, I mean a hearing where the court looked at the alternatives available and decided, based upon the evidence presented, what was the least restrictive alternative in the best interest of the child. I think the evidence that was presented at the November 17th hearing supports the court's determination that termination of parental rights was in fact the least restrictive alternative available, and the court made written findings to that effect after that hearing. Again, I'd suggest that mother had noticed that that's the way the court was going to treat the hearing, regardless of what the hearing was called. Again, nothing in the statute would prevent the court from proceeding as it did, from holding a dispositional or termination hearing, whatever we want to call that hearing, holding that hearing prior to or at the same time as a permanency hearing. Again, I think case law that existed prior to the enactment of our ASPA provisions are consistent with that approach. There are cases, and one of them was referenced in our brief, AD, where the court found that under certain circumstances, termination of parental rights can occur without delay. And in that case, there was termination of parental rights 2 months after the adjudicatory hearing. As this court noted in the IH case, nothing in ASFA should not be used as a tool to delay permanency or final outcome of a case. And I would suggest that if the court says that we have a permanency hearing that must be followed by a dispositional hearing, that in fact is what would happen. We would be delaying what would be the outcome which would occur had the ASFA provisions not been applied. I think that the old saying is pertinent or relevant in this case, and that is, if it looks like a duck, and if it quacks like a duck, and if it swims like a duck, it's a duck, regardless what we want to call it. And I think that's true as to what happened before the trial court on November 17th, that being the final hearing that occurred in this case. Regardless what it was called, it looked like a dispositional or termination hearing. It had all the parameters or requirements of a dispositional hearing. Granted, it wasn't termed or called a dispositional hearing, it was called a permanency hearing, but I would suggest that that should not affect the outcome of what truly happened.
Now, I saw language in the record after the no efforts hearing where the judge found that there were no lesser restrictive alternatives, but I didn't recall seeing that following or at or following the permanency hearing. Did you just say that
during the hearing,
either there or thereafter, was there a specific finding of fact?
There was I believe there's a specific finding in the written findings and conclusions that the termination of parental rights was the least restrictive alternative in the best interest of the child.
And what evidence was presented at the permanency hearing that supported that finding?
The worker's testimony as to her opinion and why. I believe she talked in part about the services that were provided in the past and what had been done in this case. And I unfortunately can't refer you to specific pages within the transcript, but I think again the state put on the evidence of the worker, or the testimony of the worker. Is there any other questions?
Guess not. Nobody is chastised for sitting down. Or thank you, Mr. Larson. Sir, you have 10 minutes. I'd like to open with a question based on the stipulation by the Attorney General's office now that, if factually justified, you have the right to a hearing that you're seeking.
I think there would be an argument that that would. But I hadn't actually looked at it from that standpoint. So,
representative of the state of South Dakota has just stated to this court that in all cases involving a statute, if you have the facts, you're entitled to that hearing.
And I think that we weren't given that. And I would say, related to that, in response to the fact that the position seems to be that we were on notice that we were going to have a dispositional hearing, we were just going to be calling it a permanency hearing, I would reference the court to page 65 of the reasonable efforts hearing, where the court says, as far as the due process issue here, I'm aware, as you point out, Mr. Larson, that a finding of no reasonable efforts today pretty much means that we go to 26.8A.21.2, and it appears that is the statutory scheme that there would not be the need for a termination hearing at that point, so your client is deprived a termination hearing. But I find it's not a violation of due process. I find it is well within the power of the state legislature to say that the well-being of Lucas trumps the mother's right to have a dispositional hearing. So I don't know how PW was ever on notice that we were having a dispositional hearing at the permanency hearing. And I would, tying that into what the court would say, I would say that it could be construed that the state is conceding that we should be able to have this remanded and have that hearing.
So possibility would be a remand hearing rather than striking down the statute.
The only problem I would see with that is, although I would appreciate the due process aspect of having the hearing, I don't think the scheme, frankly, allows it. She may be willing to stipulate that we should have that, but I don't think the scheme allows that, because the, if you look at 21.2, it seems to me that if the legislature enumerates specific options, that the legislature is intending to confine those options. If the legislature gives generic discretion to trial courts to act once there's been a finding, I think there's more room for an interpretation that such a hearing exists and such an option exists. The problem with a remand only without addressing the constitutionality is I still have a problem when I'm at that remand hearing if the court truly doesn't have any options other than 1 through 4. And if so, having the state tell me that they stipulate that I should be able to have such a hearing to save the statute doesn't cure this the next time it comes up, because I still have a statute that doesn't give the option to a court to do something less.
But, Mr. Larson, the statute, the introductory language to the four options says the court must determine it's appropriate. Now, doesn't that require the court to exercise some discretion? And if it finds that one of those four options are not, if it finds all four are not appropriate,
because
there's other alternatives available,
Okay. Then
you move on.
But I don't think that's what is said, because the specific words are, if the court has determined that reasonable efforts are not appropriate. That comes right after the listing of the nine exceptions to the reasonable efforts requirement. All that to me is the legislature saying, if 1 through 9 is met, then you have a permanency hearing. There is no out clause to exit out of this summary procedure back into the normal flow of a dispositional hearing, and that's the problem. The only possible one there is if the court read that somewhat confusing language in 21.2 sub 1 about placing a child for adoption and the state should file a petition for termination, that could trigger. I think the court could read that language as that would trigger a dispositional hearing. But the term petition that late in a proceeding is totally contrary to the way the word petition is used in the rest of our juvenile code, which is a way that we initiate proceedings to begin with. That's the only way I think that the constitutionality could be saved through interpretation. But even then, I don't see, I think that it does infer that there's another hearing of some type. And I think the court's ruling in IH, or at least the court's comments in IH, could indicate that this court would think it was appropriate to have a dispositional hearing, even in these abbreviated matters. And maybe 21.2 sub 1, a remand and having a dispositional hearing pursuant to that, maybe would cure the problem. But somehow it would have to be made clear that you've already got the first half of that sentence, which says place the child for adoption. So how could the court make a finding that we're going to place the file for a child for adoption and then have a dispositional hearing that's not a foregone conclusion? And that's why, as I'm talking out loud here, I don't think that saves your statute either. Because of the first clause in that sentence. I mean, it would be a fine system if you say, okay, I found that placing for adoption is appropriate. Now we're going to decide if we're going to terminate parental rights. And we're going to have a dispositional hearing.
Let me ask you this.
Okay.
The sentence right before the four options says, at the permanency hearing, the court shall determine whether and, if applicable, when, then subdivisions. So if I'm sitting there and I'm told that I should determine whether, doesn't that mean I could go through and under subdivisions 1, 2, 3, and 4 say, none of these are appropriate. This permanency hearing is resulting in nothing permanent, therefore we need to go on to other dispositions. Isn't that an option that I have because of that language?
If you had a sub 5 judge over that said none of the above, maybe so.
But the word whether.
But I think whether has to do with, for example, I think you could do a combination. You could say that there would be a relative placement followed by a legal guardianship, and that's why the whether and the when would be. I don't see anything between the whether and when that kicks you out of 1 through 4. I would like there to be one, but I don't see one. I think the trial judges in an egregious case would try to wedge one in there, but I don't see the statute allowing it.
You don't see the word whether allowing the converse, the or not, that I see when I read that.
Well, why would they, I guess, just thinking out loud, why would they make four enumerated options if the whether didn't have to do with whether adoption or legal guardianship is appropriate, and if so, when that should be? That's, to me, the only way that the enumeration makes sense with the phrase whether and if so, when.
Well, isn't that answer obvious? If the four options don't work, you go to some other option. If the four options aren't appropriate.
But then why would you only enumerate four options as a legislature?
because there's other statutes providing for other dispositions.
But there's nothing that allows us, that's my whole point, Justice Zinner, is, and I think the main case, Heather C., that's cited by the state, there is an out clause after a finding of the what they call aggravating factors in Maine, where there's an out clause where the court can kick it back into the dispositional phase. And I think that's where the mistake was made when this was kind of plugged into another set of statutes without reconciling them, is we didn't make an out clause, and there needs to be one for it not to be constitutionally infirm. In summary, this is a situation where parental rights are a fundamental interest. I've been doing this long enough to understand that there are times where there needs to be more of an expedited procedure. However, that can never be so expedited that the opportunity to present options and least restrictive alternatives, even at the end of a summary procedure, is not allowed a parent to protect their fundamental liberty interest to their child by arguing that there is some less restrictive alternative than the four options listed in 21.2. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Court will be in recess till tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
You're listening to oral arguments of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The court is in recess and will resume shortly. For more information about the court, please log on to www.sdjudicial.com.